who's the real David Paterson, the affable man who became governor when Elliot Spitzer resigned in the midst of a scandal? A beleaguered incompetent who wasn't prepared to handle such a demanding job, or the finger-wagging disciplinarian who has been scolding the state Senate for its lack of action? The media have given us a number of different versions of New York's accidental governor, but what is he like up close and in person, and how is he handling the day-to-day governing of New York State? A couple of weeks ago, WNYC's Bob Henley spent a day camped out in the governor's Manhattan office. He observed a test match, witnessed the signing of an important but little-noticed piece of legislation, and talked with Governor Paterson about the challenges and rewards of his job. Bob Henley joins us now. Hi, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
The governor told you his workday usually begins around 6:30 or 7 a.m. and ends after 11 p.m. How much of the time did you spend with him?
Well, I have to first credit a book that made me, by Jim Bishop, called A Day in the Life of President Kennedy, and my mom gave it to me when I was a kid. And I was always taken with that concept of getting inside the political life of somebody. So there was some negotiation that went on even to get a chance to do this because of the fact that he has the issue of the vision question. They're very protective of him, not to mention what's happened with the media. So I spent the whole working day with him. I didn't go with him to the holiday parties, but I got a good sense of the diverse challenges that he faces. And he really seems to enjoy it. I mean, that's the thing. When you, for instance, finish here on the air and you come out of the studio, it's that between time that we can take a measure of an individual. And he seems to really relish it, even in that between time.
I met him some years ago when he was on a panel about stem cell research that I was moderating. And I was struck by what a firm grasp he had of the material and how downright witty he was. I mean, there were some important scientists there and other famous people, and he kind of stole the show. So I was surprised by how incompetent he seemed to come across not long after he took office. And then there were even those Saturday Night Live routines with him holding papers upside down, making fun of the fact that he's legally blind.
Well, there is an odd combination of vulnerability and courage in his persona. The idea of having such a high-profile job as New York State's governor and being legally blind all at the same time. And what I saw in him in the way that he negotiates his day is there's an affability that he uses so that he can own a room. I describe it that way. So that there's a disarming nature and a self-effacing nature of his humor, which in politics we don't see very much of. We like the strong personalities, the alpha male, to take charge. So that kind of mix of vulnerability and courage, well, it gets lost in the translation. You're right about the substance issues. When we look back, he came in 2008. Since we've seen him reform the Rockefeller drug laws, that's been kicking around for as long as I've been on the beat. We've seen Tier 5 pension reform, which is going to result in tens of billions of dollars of savings. That's the idea of having the state's public employees and public employees throughout the state have a retirement plan. It's a little closer to what people in the private sector got. Not as generous, but more in line with the fact people are living longer. So it's going to mean they're going to have to pay a little bit more into it. And then we saw a reform of the independent authorities, which is something we've been talking about for 15 years. These are these huge behemoths like the MTA that really are their own law to themselves. And people often aren't aware of what they do until they show up on the front page, like with the Erie Canal caper. You must remember that one. That's one where there's this asset, the Erie Canal, part of the patrimony of New York State, gets manipulated and twisted and sold for a small percentage of its real value. These authorities, $150 billion in collective debt, no transparency, no sunlight. That bill was signed in on his watch.
That kind of independence actually goes back to the days when Robert Moses
exactly.
Was creating similar authorities, and we really haven't changed. So you say that was the bill you saw him sign?
Exactly.
Why wasn't that a big story in the newspapers?
I think part of it is the fact that we are in the Tiger Wood age of Balloon Boy, that kind of thing where you don't see in-depth beat reporting anymore. To understand what's been going on with independent authorities and utilities, you have to have been paying attention for a long time and have the discipline of following the story and being able to understand. It's also kind of a good news story. I mean, what kind of headline is that? You know, Albany takes actions and solves a problem. What percentage is there in that, Leonard?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is legislation that was introduced a long time ago. Have other governors not gotten behind it?
It is. You have to understand that the people that are on these boards are often the political contributors who have supported the candidates of both parties, you know, the two-party system, the ongoing criminal conspiracy. And so it is something that has tremendous power for patronage. And so you have Assemblyman Brodsky, who was a champion of this, along with Senator Bill Perkins, pushing, but it never came to fruition. David Patterson has the experience of having been both in the Assembly and the Senate. He's been the consummate insider, so he knows how to get things done.
I spoke recently to somebody who used to serve in the state Senate, and he said to me that whenever he had a great idea and he offered it to the Democratic leadership, he said Shelley would say, well, let's slow this whole thing down. No need to rush it. Let's take a real good hard look at it. And he said that's the reason why everything takes so darn long.
Yeah, I think
I don't know if it's all Shelley's fault.
No, I think it has to do with the sheer size of New York State, some 60-odd counties, hundreds and hundreds of municipalities. And, you know, I think also what's happened to a large degree is that the reduction in the newspaper reporting on these matters makes it so that the political pressure has really diminished to a large degree.
My guess is Bob Hennelly, who is political reporter here at WNYC, and he actually spent a day with Governor David Patterson, which was the subject of a very nice news piece, but it left me wanting to know a lot more, Bob, and I'm glad that we were able to put you on the show. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you came to WNYC as an expert on New Jersey politics. How similar, how different is Albany from Trenton and New York politics from New Jersey politics?
I think that New Jersey has the phenomena of the two media markets, where southern New Jersey is dominated in the influence of Philadelphia, and the northern part is in the bandwidth of New York. So that creates this kind of split.
And the Star Ledger plays no role in this?
Well, the Star Ledger itself is retrenching. I mean, when I first came into the news business and the print trade in the Ridgewood newspapers, the Hudson Dispatch, you started with one municipality. And so you got to know that town. And so you went to the meetings at night. You went to the school board meetings. Then, like 5 or 6 years later, it was, can you do four towns? Can you do a county? Can you do three counties? And now we see a situation where there really isn't a presence at a lot of these local and county meetings. Even state authorities often go uncovered. New York has a similar kind of split between New York City and Albany, that downstate and upstate phenomena. So if you don't read the really four separate press zones, you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Does the governor know all of that? He does have the site problem. How does he get around that?
Well, first of all, he has a loyalty that he's inspired from his staff that is fairly impressive. And that's that, I guess, that nurturing environment that he creates. I think also the fact that they've been through this pressure for these last couple of months where they were really so many negative stories have kind of like glazed them like a kind of ceramic pot. There's a unity and a tightness there. Also, because of his infirmity and his vulnerability, the staff really watches out for him almost like an extension of the body detail. So that's an attention to detail and concern for his well-being.
But when there's a complicated piece of legislation, does somebody sit and read it all to him?
Well, he has what he does do is he mentioned he starts his day by he does a lot of radio, where he keeps a constant conversation throughout the state, which can sometimes drive his staff crazy because he can get out ahead of whatever the day's events are because he's speaking spontaneously. And then also he has people, he covers the clips, he does have people checking with him that he has conversations with. He also has an ability to do deep listening. And that's something that is a lost art. This is something someone like yourself is a consummate listener. It's like, you're not, while I'm talking, you're not thinking what you're going to say next. You're listening to what I'm saying. And so that
sometimes.
Sometimes. But no, that's another thing he has that ability to do is listen deeply. And I think also look for a way of putting people at ease. That's the other thing he does pretty well.
You describe some of Governor Patterson's meetings with groups that don't receive a lot of media attention. For example, students from a Brooklyn high school who won a state chess championship. How much time does he spend with this community contact on a typical day?
What's interesting is I took some beverages and basically camped out in the reception area of the governor's office here at 33rd Avenue and did this thing where I put the microphone where it was visible. So people knew, on top of the New York State tour guide, that this was an experiment. And they'd say, what are you doing? I'm saying, well, I'm kind of like a political anthropologist. So when you're there at like 9, 10, 11, noon, one, people begin to think you're part of the furniture and you're interactive with it. In this case of the Edward R. Murrow chess champions, who have, I guess, won the New York State championship 10 times in a row, a beautiful rainbow of New York City high school geniuses. You can't imagine speaking every kind of language under the sun, all more brilliant than the other.
And from Brooklyn, by the way.
Exactly. They've been on the chess coach has been on your show. He mentioned that to me. And so what was fascinating to me is how they dealt with the challenge, a kind of spontaneous challenge, where the kids had all this energy and they were going to do a photo op. And the chess coach says, well, listen to his Governor Patterson's staff person. We'd like to do something different with the photo op. We'd like to play chess with him. And so the advanced guy's little color comes out of his face, and he says, well, there's two problems with that. One is I don't know that the governor plays chess, and two, he may not be able to see the pieces. So time goes on. They get the kids lined up to do the a photograph, and they create the photo op scene with the chess set. The governor comes in. There's a little apprehension in the room. He sits down and plays like a champ. There's like a tactile recognition of the pieces. He plays a few, makes a few moves, resigns, and then has a very interesting spontaneous conversation interaction with the kids where they can ask him questions. And so he clearly took time out of his day, and I think it was something that they'll never forget.
And you observed a group of Native American tribal chiefs waiting to see the governor. We don't hear a lot about Indian politics in New York State. Do we know what they discussed?
No. Also, the thing about that space down here in New York City is it's two stories with about 200 employees. So it's entirely possible that they were to see maybe his chief counsel or a cabinet officer, because here in New York City, they kind of have the same top offices that they have in Albany.
When he took office, Governor Patterson was praised for being able to reach across the state and across the aisle and work well with everyone during his 21-year tenure in the legislature. These days, it seems like his relationship with the state legislature couldn't be more contentious. What's happened?
Well, I think you have the Senate, the state Senate, which did this kind of unique implosion where the margin is so close. If one person has a bad day in the Senate majority, the state of New York has a major problem.
Well, in the old days, you had the legislature controlled by the Democrats and the Senate controlled by Republicans, and now you have this razor-thin majority in the Senate as well.
Yeah, and it is a new algebra, and I think also, as much as it may look like he doesn't have a good relationship, there's a lot of breastfeeding that goes on. Like when Governor Patterson was faced, he said, with the prospect of New York State being insolvent. I mean, that's significant. He said the state only was going to have $35 million by the end of this month. And you consider the state, it has a $130 billion budget. You understand that $35 million is not a lot of money. He did something where he said, listen, if you don't meet my budget cut requirements, I am not going to execute and cut checks. People promised to sue him from the legislature. Didn't happen. They were almost relieved that somebody showed some kind of leadership.
Why are we facing this insolvency? I know New York State took some hit because of the economic crisis here, but we've been bouncing back better than most of the country, haven't we?
Bouncing back is a relative term. I think that because of the dominance of the financial networks, we see people jumping up and down when they see the stock market, but there's been a deep economic trauma that's been done to the working class in this country that will take a generation to recover. And New York State, especially in areas like the Route 28 corridor, and even in areas throughout the state where there's been long-term issues of underemployment, they are having a hard time. If they had scarcity before, they face the same wall of foreclosures. Now, we have really put off doing things that we needed to do. The state has been continuing to spend and borrow, and when it got new revenue, it spent it. It didn't roll it forward. It didn't save a rainy day fund, and it continued to extend pensions and promises of benefits for public employees that far outstripped the carrying capacity of the state economy.
Well, he spoke to you about how he felt about having to cut social service programs that he himself had pushed for as a legislator, and we have a little clip from that. Let's listen to it.
Internally, it's killing me. Legislation that I sponsored to bring $50 million to help victims of lead poisoning, young people in older apartments where lead was still in the paint, was legislation I introduced with an assemblyman in 2004 and 2008. I actually saw it pass and then vetoed it because we didn't have the money to pay for the program. And I got a dressing down from my friend and colleague. I felt like I was being lectured by my parents and I was a child. And I'll protect his name for privacy, but his initials are Assemblyman David Gant. And he really let me have it over vetoing that bill, but I told him, if I make an exception for a bill that I sponsored some years ago, then I will not be able to govern with the integrity that I need to make the drastic cuts at this time.
Now, he makes a good case to you. You could agree or disagree, but he makes a good case. Why isn't he making such a good case to the general public? His approval ratings are a little better. They're disasters.
I think the problem here is that, let's face it, he'd be the first to admit that there were mistakes made early on. He came on like gangbusters in that first, you may remember that press conference where he left the New York Media Corps slack-jawed, which is kind of hard to do when he tried to inoculate himself against his own picadillos, owned up to marital infidelities, disclosures about drug use. We hadn't seen anything like that in a long time.
It's a commonplace.
It's a strategy. Yeah, David Patterson
media
strategy.
Maybe we should
take
up golf.
Right. And so he came on very strong in the beginning. He had certainly was out ahead on the AIG matter, the insurance giant having trouble. Then the whole, I think, business around the furtive bid of Carolyn Kennedy for the Senate seat, that was where he got caught up in the switches, and that was mishandled all the way around.
Well, we'll take a little break and we'll come back to those things. My guest is Bob Hennelly, who spent a day with Governor David Patterson. There was a news report. I'm sure there's something on the web as well.
Indeed.
And he is now talking about it in greater detail on our show. We'll be back with more of that right after this. We're back with Bob Hennelly talking about his day with David Patterson. By the way, there's a link to his extended interview on our show page at WNYC.org. We talked about his popularity ratings. His approval rating fell from 55% to 26% during his first year in office. And they've gone up a bit now. He's at 40%, which still means 60% disapproval or something like that. And you say he admits to having made mistakes?
Yeah, I think that he's actually thriving in this period of time of being underestimated. I think that that's something personally that keeps him on his game. I think that things began to turn around a little bit once he got Richard Ravitz at his side. You know, he won that court battle. He's got a lieutenant governor, a finer man on understanding the fine points of government and bureaucracies and getting things done. You couldn't find. Richard Ravitz is a great guy to have in that position. And then also, there's the behind-the-scenes thing where you had Attorney General Cuomo weighing in and clearing his throat and saying, this isn't constitutional, and the court said to Cuomo, no, that's okay. So, but subtly, the tide turned a little bit, and then you've had this steady series of accomplishments that Patterson has been able to take credit for, and then he's developing a persona again. That's the thing, you know, New Yorkers like a new show, so we have to have new characters, and so now he is the budget disciplinarian.
Well, the tide seemed to turn to some degree when he took so long in deciding who would replace Hillary Clinton.
The first
Clinton.
Tide turning downward, right.
Yeah, and you had to wonder why he took so long. And then there were those suggestions that he might have been behind all the negative whispering campaign that was conducted against Caroline Kennedy.
I think part of it was the effort itself was so flawed and in some ways so contrary to the Kennedy ethic. The idea that someone of privilege, like Caroline Kennedy, would seek a special appointment. I mean, that family's always had some of its best moments when they declare themselves as a candidate standing for election. There's a kind of humility inherent in that. So I think also the people behind the Caroline Kennedy nomination made too much of it themselves. And then Patterson dragged it out in terms of constantly talking about it with the media, and he really didn't have the discipline that was required.
Well, you know, when if you're appointed to office, there's a good chance that the next time you run, you have the power of the incumbency. So you got to get into the office some way or another.
Here's the strategy. Imagine if she had just had a midterm press conference and said, I am announcing my candidacy for the office of U.S. Senate, like anyone else. Then that puts Patterson in an interesting position. He can either appoint someone of stature who will hold as a placeholder, or he'll say, well, in light of the fact she's serious, but that's not the strategy they played.
Yeah, but Kirsten Gillibrand didn't announce that she was going to run for Senate either. And a lot of liberals disagreed with his appointment of her. She's a centrist Democrat who was endorsed by the NRA. Has that opposition softened at all since?
I think a lot of this comes from the neophyte mistakes made by the Obama White House about assessing the politics on the ground. They've really not had a good batting average when it came to provincial politics. They thought, for instance, that three visits for John Corzine in New Jersey would turn the tide. Didn't happen. They thought that Rudy Giuliani was a big threat to Albany and that they had to get Andrew Cuomo in there as attorney general because Rudy Giuliani was just couldn't wait to get and run for governor and would beat Patterson. It didn't come to pass. They thought they couldn't hold Gillibrand's seat. That didn't happen though either. So it's not just Patterson.
Well, Giuliani announced today that he isn't going to make a run for the Senate, but he still may challenge David Patterson.
Well, no. What's happening actually today is he's announcing he's going to endorse Lazio, the Republican candidate for governor, and they're being very coy about what his U.S. Senate plans are. But it's been widely reported that he's going to be pretty much involved with this new international persona of making Rio safe for the World Cup and the Olympics. So that seems to be where he's turning. He's been down there visiting favelas, trying to bring some of the same esprit de corps that he credits himself, and many people do, independent observers, for what happened here in New York City, down to Rio, because they have a significant problem there with welcoming the world.
He'll become Rio's mayor. Or Brazil's mayor. Do you think that Patterson could have done anything to resolve the stalemate between the state Senate's Democrats and Republicans last June? Or is that situation beyond control?
See, that's a good point. I mean, that was where the fact that there was weakness in the executive branch created this kind of chaotic moment where there was no power to hold anyone accountable.
And to some degree, Barack Obama is facing the same problem now with the fight over the health care bill. Whether he is handling the job well or not is for somebody to decide somewhere down the line. But people are blaming him, despite the fact that there is so much going on in the Senate with all this trading and people making deals.
Well, that vacuum that can happen reminds me of that period of time before a storm where the atmosphere is unresolved and anything could happen. And in that environment, people that are disciplined, whether they're pursuing their own agenda or something ideological, but if they have drive, can really eat up the landscape, unless it's a countervailing force. And in that case, Patterson was not up to the requirement that history offered him.
And then we come to same-sex marriage. In May last year, the governor issued a directive requiring state agencies to recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states. Some people say he hasn't done enough to push the state legislature, but he did come out strongly for it, and the bill failed 38-24 in the Senate this year.
Right. He did follow up with an executive order on transgender discrimination within the state workforce, but that's another example where it's true. He did not have the leverage, and there was nothing that anyone was afraid of that he could do to them. It's not like he's an overbearing personality like FDR. Like, if you cross him, you're going to have a problem. So I guess from his standpoint now, what he's got to do is focus on what's possible, get it done, and keep your eye on what is absolutely essential that you do have control over, which is the state spending.
And the governor said that he's concerned about the state's credit rating going down. What would that mean to the state?
Well,
does this compare to what we've seen in California?
Right. Well, of course, New York State's like $130 billion, which is number two behind California in the scale of the budget. The problem is that we've been barring our way out of our challenges and choices for a long time. So now we have $10 billion in debt service sitting on all our hopes and ambitions. Debt service, what is that? That is the credit card charge. That's just the money you've got to pay every year to keep your creditors happy. Doesn't get you any new daycare slots, doesn't provide any new outreach for the homeless. That's just to keep your creditors happy. So we're kind of jammed in that. We have to reinvent how we govern. One of the things that they're frustrated with up in Albany is there are many local school districts, and to his credit, Controller Tom DiNapoli's made this point, that are sitting on, get ready for this, in this time of scarcity, over $1 billion in surpluses that are above and beyond what they need to carry on their local books.
And how do they justify that?
They didn't have to. And now what's happening is as the state enforces fiscal discipline, there is a downward impact that's going to be felt. Unfortunately, the governor's in the tough spot is that in this position as governor, the only way that he can stop the state from spending is to stop the checks that are going out without any attention to what they're for. Because once he begins to say, oh, no, I want to send this to the district that doesn't have a surplus, he is legislating. So it does create this kind of phenomena of using a sledgehammer as opposed to a scalpel.
I'm talking to WNYC political reporter Bob Hennelly. He spent a day with Governor Patterson and has been looking a lot at state politics recently. He switched his allegiance from New Jersey to New York.
I still love New Jersey. Please.
Lately, the governor has praised Wall Street, calling it the economic engine of New York. But wasn't it Wall Street's near collapse that landed our state in this financial situation? And also, right now, isn't it still seen as the bad boy of American the American economic system?
The thing that Patterson is trying to deal with is, you know, right now the only silver lining is the fact that Wall Street seems to be turning around. So the city and the state are feeling some initial loosening up in terms of tax revenues on that front. But that almost pales into insignificance when you talk about the decline of property values, the slide that's happened across the country, the loss of employment for people, and the prospect of, dare I say it, 10% unemployment further notice. And so, you know, I think basically he's trying to talk up the economy. But the bottom line is we're still left, like you said, I don't think we've done the forensic evaluation to understand what exactly happened. We were so busy propping up the banks, I don't think we did the work to find out what went wrong.
I'd like to play another clip from your interview. Here you ask the governor to give the federal government a grade on how it's responding to the economic crisis on the local level.
I'd give them an A. And the only reason I don't give them an A+ is because they, and it's probably not their fault, have not been able to get much cooperation from the Republican Party in the House or the Senate. New York has now received $31 billion in the stimulus package. We have benefited for the first time in probably 150 years from aid to Washington. We generally pay 60, 70, in 2007, $86.9 billion more to the federal government than we received back in taxes.
But hasn't the state received some federal stimulus dollars?
The problem is that that's very short term, and it will only get us through like the next budget cycle. And what I think that something we have to be concerned about is if you see the public sector, towns, counties, and states, and I include New Jersey, New York, the entire country, begin to slim down their workforce, public workforce, it could put us down into another double dip just as we're beginning to think we're turning out of it.
Well, a group of teachers' unions and school officials is suing the governor over his decision to delay $750 million in scheduled payments to schools and local governments that have been authorized by the government, by the legislature. They claim he acted beyond his authority. Isn't it the legislature that is supposed to hold the purse strings in the government?
Well, except for the question of the narrow question, as I said before, of solvency. It is the legislature's responsibility to appropriate and make budget priority. But in terms of whether or not the state has money, period, that resides in the executive.
The New York Post reported yesterday that Governor Patterson's campaign committee has just hired Judd Legum, the former research director for Hillary Clinton's primary campaign, supposedly to dig up dirt on Andrew Cuomo.
These are whispers. It's like that piece in the New York Times about the three sources that said the White House wanted to throw David Patterson under the bus. If people don't put their names out there, and if you just can't repeat it. I have no knowledge that that's any kind of a, he's getting ready for a campaign. He certainly is ready to be competitive.
But all of the signs are that he's going to have a hard time getting people behind him. I'm not sure the state Democratic Party is all that hot for him. I don't know whether Charles Schumer is strongly behind him. If President Obama is also kind of lukewarm, what kind of a chance does he have?
Well, I mean,
and Andrew Cuomo is incredibly popular.
Yeah, I think the issue about Obama, to some degree, who could imagine? Look at the president's numbers. Okay, back when the story surfaced about the Obama administration allegedly wanting to disappear David Patterson from the governorship and hand it to Andrew Cuomo, there was one set of numbers, and that was around the same period of time that John Corzine was going to win and President Obama was going to turn it around. Maybe by that the campaign season of 2010, the fact that President Obama doesn't want David Patterson as governor would be something that would give voters, you know, some kind of positive reference. It's very hard to, you know, look at it's dynamic. You have to look at where things are going to be 5 or 6 months from now. If Patterson continues to accomplish things, stays the course, and has fiscal discipline, and he doesn't have another kind of Carolyn Kennedy thing, we'll have to see.
Well, what's happening in California with Arnold Schwarzenegger? Is he scoring high marks for his handling?
I think that the thing with California is that they have been talking about going to the U.S. Treasury, and that's something that for short-term borrowing. And that's one thing I was very interested in Patterson's response. He was like, no, we just can't. It's kind of a self-reliance thing. You know, the idea of like reclaiming the concept of the Empire State. We're just not going to go and borrow money from the federal treasury to get out of this problem.
But what would happen if the state became insolvent?
Well, even the hint of it begins to drive up the way that people look at taking the risk of lending the state money, and your interest rate costs go up, and then you see this $10 billion debt service balloon, and then you find yourself unable to make choices for the future. Your past makes all of your decisions for the future.
I suspect he's counting on the state coming out of this okay, and then he'll be able to take credit, although there's always that other side. People often blame the person who's in office for the problems.
Right, and there has been this anti-incumbent sensibility. We saw Swazi, we saw, you know, Corzine. That's true. And I guess the question is, what happens in terms of is there a sense that he has been able to turn this thing around so that there's a sense of confidence that people want to give him another 4 years?
I get the feeling that you went into this this experiment not exactly sure what you would think, and you came out of it with very strong positive feelings about David Patterson.
I do, in the sense that he seems to have delivered things that have been talked about for a long time legislatively that haven't gotten front page treatment. And so that gave me pause to some degree. And then also, I think the fact that he does seem to have this core set of beliefs about what it's going to take to get the state out of the current economic crisis. I mean, one of the odd things about the position the White House is in is that it's talking about prosperity, but also it understands people have to be fiscally conservative. So, he seems to be headed in the right direction for now.
My great thanks to WNYC's Bob Hennelly. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
On tomorrow's show, I'll speak with Glenn Hubbard, Dean of the Columbia Business School, on the flaws he sees with foreign aid and how developing nations can eliminate poverty. Then actress Bryce Dallas Howard and director Jodie Markell on their new film, The Loss of a Teardrop Diamond, based on a rediscovered Tennessee Williams screenplay. Also, cartoonist Gayon Wilson discusses his 5 decades of publishing cartoons in Playboy, and Gore Vidal. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Stephanie Bernhardt, Andrea Maraskin, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Michael Lupica was at the audio controls. I am Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.